Okay, any questions on stuff we talked about in that first period? We're going to finish up the stomach here and then move on. Stomach cancer is actually something that is beginning to increase now again. It went through a dip, as did gastric esophageal cancer, particularly as we moved away from nitrate-preserved meats and smoked meats and things, and the incidence of that malignancy dropped, and now it's picked up again, largely because of the strain of H. pylori that we are dealing with. Gastric cancers have two basic appearances, and that is to say they may grow. They're adenocarcinomas, or glandular carcinomas, and they either come from the epithelial cells that basically line that stomach that create the mucosa, or the mucin-secreting cells that give rise to the snot that's out there on the surface. And they're not the same cells. So this right here would be a fairly typical and more frequently seen kind of cancer. Kind of grows like a coral growth, and it's just, you know, one cell has a couple of mutations and it accumulates and it begins to proliferate and grow. If it occurs up in this part of the stomach, it can be there for a long time before it makes itself evident. Here it might give itself away because of obstruction of the outflow, but if it's up in here, it can be there for a while, and then by the time it does become known, it's already metastatic. Gastric cancers are notorious for that, and by the time we come around to making the diagnosis, they're typically spread and they're almost impossible to cure. The things that we still see that cause them would be chronic irritants. We can see malignancies arise in people with a chronic H. pylori infection and the chronic gastritis because of that. Still smoked meats and nitrites, and still an important correlating factor is cigarette smoking. A lot of the carcinogens that are absorbed through the lungs come out in the urine, they come out in body secretions, and that includes secretions here in the GI tract. And so you might see cancers that are related to cigarette smoke. You might say, well, you're not really smoking through your stomach. But on the other hand, the carcinogens that get absorbed into the bloodstream do end up in various body water, various fluids, and so on. This is the second form. You'll notice that the cancer doesn't actually have a big exophytic growth. Doesn't look like a coral growth. And this is a cancer that leads to a very rigid stomach. And again, this is something that is, by the time it comes to be recognized, it's almost always metastatic. The individual cells are the mucin-secreting cells, and you will see that the cell looks like what we call a signet ring in a way. Each cell has a big vacuole within it, and it's got the nucleus kind of pressed off to the side. See, a signet ring is kind of like your class ring or the family crest ring. You know, in years past, when we didn't have cell phones, can't imagine it myself, but there really was a time like that, evidently. And you would, if you wanted to send a message to somebody, get this, all right? You actually sat down and wrote it down on a piece of paper, and you imagine such a thing. And you would fold the piece of paper up, and you would put a little bit of wax, sealing wax, on it, and you'd press the ring set into the wax, and that was your signature. Actually, it was your signature because the odds are pretty good you couldn't read or write. You know, if you were really of the wealthy class, the upper crust, reading and writing was something that people with a limp wrist did. You know, you wouldn't want to be doing that. So reading and writing was just out of the picture for you. So you would dictate your letter to somebody else because you were so damned important. But to show it was you, you'd press in that wax before it set up. You'd press your ring set. And then somebody took that off. And in a way, this to somebody looked like one of those signature rings, and there was the ring, the opening in the ring, and that was the ring set over there. This is often called a signet ring carcinoma for that reason. And it doesn't grow as a gland-like thing because these are actually mucin-secreting cells and not really the glandular cells that composed the mucosa itself. Okay. Yeah. This one here? I'm sorry, the question? No, this is the two, we see two different kinds of cancers of the stomach. Either this that comes from the surface epithelial cells that creates the barrier. I mean, creates the actual physical barrier as opposed to the snot. And the other is that signet ring carcinoma. And those are specialized cells within the mucosa that produce the mucin that gets put out on the surface.
Okay.
Okay, line-on is plastic, and that meant the leather wine bottle, the stomach becomes very rigid. And here you can see the tumor has spread throughout. That's what's being depicted here. It's in the muscle. It doesn't create kind of this exophytic growth. Now, before I go ahead and get myself in deeper trouble, let me just tell you that half my friends are gay. Okay, one of my best friends is gay. So, I mean, I have nothing against, by making that snide remark, I was simply implying that in the past, people who were of means had somebody around, and it was typically seen as non-masculine. If you could read and write, actually, you kept it to yourself because it was really viewed as being non-masculine. Okay, small bowel disease. small bowel disease is somewhat simpler than everything we've talked about to this point in that we don't see a lot of tumors and things like that, but we do see something that is related to the fact that the small bowel is so long, and that would be entrapment of the bowel or twisting up of the bowel, getting caught in itself even. So mechanical aspects of causing obstruction or compression of the small bowel. Now we can have infections of the small bowel, and we can have tumors arise there, but those are somewhat unusual, and most of the times the tumors are related to the lymphoid tissue that's there, additional tissue that's present in the GI tract. But this is just showing some of the things that can occur with problems, mechanical related things. Again, everything's being propelled along in the small bowel by peristaltic action. And that peristaltic action can't work if we have some compression like incarcerated inguinal hernia here. Occasionally, it will produce something very peculiar called an intussusception, and that is where the bowel sort of sleeves inside of itself. It's kind of like when you take off, you know, maybe taking off your coat, you get the sleeve inverted in itself in a way. But it actually, part of the bowel picks up another part of the bowel and sort of snakes it into itself through peristaltic action. And as it pulls it ahead, it will eventually compress the bowel, and part of it will die because of the limited vascular flow. So these are some things that are mechanical in nature that we see in the small bowel, particularly post-surgical. If someone's had a surgery in the past and they've got scarring in the bowel, there shouldn't be any scar tissue in the abdominal cavity. But if there's scar tissue, bands of scar tissue, parts of the bowel are scarred down to the wall of the abdomen, something can twist around that. And these are how these kind of mechanical obstructions or compressions or things like that occur. Now, the intussusception business, the most common site is right here. It occurs in children more often than adults. It can occur as a consequence of having a little benign polyp. If you have a little benign polyp and the peristaltic wave is sort of pinching itself and pushing the cheeseburgers along, all right, if it also grabs hold of that polyp, it can start pulling the polyp along and pull it into itself. And so it might actually cause the bowel to slide or be pulled into itself. This is the most common site, ileocecal valve, and more often than not, we see that in children. And you can actually reduce that. We do a barium enema and push the barium around, which we get the x-ray with, but it also causes the thing to sort of pop back into place. But you will see here that what's happening is you've also got bleeding and stuff because of the compression of the vascular supply, the mesentery that's coming along with that portion of small bowel. I wouldn't say it's trivial. That kid is screaming like they've never screamed. If you have kids, you know they can really yell and they can scream, and they tend to do that at 2:30 in the morning when they want something. But when this kid screams, they're screaming, and then they get real quiet. And when the kid is quiet and looks like hell, you know there's really something wrong. And it will definitely lead to infarction of the bowel and bacteria getting into the bloodstream and things like that, leading to sepsis. So intussusception is something I'd like you to know about. This is a curious little malformity that a fair percentage of people have. It's called a Meckel's diverticulum. Maybe you've heard about it. It occurs in the very distal end of the bowel, way down in the ileum. And it has an interesting thing about it, and that is it goes by what we call the rule of twos. It has two kinds of mucosa. I think it's twice as common in males than females. It's 2 feet from the ileocecal valve. It's 2 inches in size and so forth. Now, typically, it's just a blinding little thing right here. And what gets people into trouble will be things will get caught in here, food or stuff. Well, not food at that point, it's pretty well digested. And it can fester. If you have two kinds of mucosa, see, the other kind of mucosa that might be there is gastric. Okay, if you have gastric mucosa in something that's way down in the small bowel, what's the gastric mucosa making that shouldn't be making down there? Stomach acid. Alrighty, so we're way the heck away from the stomach, but if it has gastric mucosa, that's going to respond to the gastrin just the way the stomach wall will, and so it's busy producing acid. Well, you'll have ulcerations down here. But it can get infected. Some people, the old term was a second appendix. It's not an appendix, but when we do an abdominal surgery, they always look to see if anybody has an Eccles diverticulum. And they used to come out with real regularity. I'd see it about once a month at the hospital. And typically when someone's signing an op permit, it will say in there that if something untoward is found, I give permission to go ahead and fix it at that point. And almost always what it was, it'd be doing a hysterectomy, doing a surgery for something, and spotted the Meckel's diverticulum and go ahead and call in a general surgeon to finish it up and take that out at that time. Because this thing is going to cause you trouble somehow later. If you know it's there, you take the sucker out. Just that simple. And where it'll cause you trouble is a place you really don't want it. Now here's one thing, I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. Because occasionally a Meckel's diverticulum is connected by a little frenulum of tissue to the umbilicus. Most times it's not, but sometimes it is. And that allows the bowel to kind of wind itself up around that. And if it gets wound up like that, it can pinch off its own vascular supply. This is just showing some of the things that we can have with the Meckel's. It can actually serve as a nidus for intussusception, things of that sort. I have never seen a cancer in it, but I've seen plenty of them ulcerated because of the gastric mucosa. I suppose cancer is a remote possibility. You see, you don't want this happening. If you know it's there, you take care of it. It's just like an inguinal hernia or something. If you know it's there, you fix it. Because when it's going to go wrong is when you're on the family vacation and you're in southern Utah and you're at Arches National Park, which is a beautiful spot. If you've never been there, I highly recommend it. And all of a sudden, one of the kids is screaming like hell because something's wrong, and the closest place is Moab, which is a really funky little town. If you get a chance, go there. It's kind of fun. And the hospital has 4 beds. And maybe they've got a surgeon, and maybe they don't. And somebody's going to die before you end up getting someplace bigger, you know. That's if you knew about this sucker 5 years ago when an abdominal surgery was done and you left it in as a surgeon, it's malpractice. So at any rate, Meckel's diverticulae are curiosity. It's a developmental abnormality. It's a little pouch off the wall of the bowel. It's not the same as diverticula of the colon, which we'll look at in just a little while here. All right, so that's a situation, a developmental situation with the small bowel. So we've looked at mechanical problems, and what I've mentioned a couple of times there is that when you have torsion of the bowel, the wrapping up of the bowel, or intussusception, is that we're going to end up infarcting the bowel. And why does that happen? Well, the bowel has kind of a funky vascular supply, and it all has to come through the mesentery. And if we stretch that mesentery too far or twist it up, we're going to compress off the vein. And if blood can't go through the vein, it cannot transit, obviously, through the capillary bed. It couldn't have come through. You might say the artery is still open. Well, big deal. You still are going to kill off part of the bowel. Bowel infarctions, vascular events, are a significant problem, particularly among elderly people, whether it's a thrombosis or an occlusion in a vein or an artery. The effect is exactly the same, and that is that there's no blood going through the GI tract, and so that section of the bowel is going to die. It's going to have an ischemic death. In the case of the bowel, this is where we see hemorrhagic infarcts. If you had an occlusion in a coronary artery, we have what's called an anemic infarct or a white infarct, because that is an end artery system where an artery divides, that divides, that divides, and sort of pyramidal in a way. If you plug up a vessel at the very beginning, everything down there dies. There's no real collateralization or much. Here, there's a lot of overlap, a lot of collateralization. You can see all this nest of blood vessels here. If you occlude one of those, you might find that there's enough trickle of blood so that when there's not enough to keep it alive, but there's a trickle of blood from some other area that it will bleed into that when the blood vessels begin to break down. And they will break down like everything else too. So the outcome, interestingly enough, is the same. Whether it's a venous occlusion or arterial occlusion, it's a hemorrhagic infarct. But what happens here when the bowel dies and the mucosa sloughs off, again, there's still some trickle of blood through there, and it's enough for the bacteria then to get into the bloodstream, and they proliferate, and then you're going to have septic shock and going to die. This is extremely painful. It isn't something that a person is going to be able to put up with for very long. We see it in elderly people because of atherosclerosis involving the aorta and the main vascular trunks that come off there, the vessels, superior mesenteric and inferior mesenteric arteries, celiac. We can also see it in people who have inflammation in the GI tract or inflammation in the abdominal cavity, because if these vessel walls, particularly the veins, become inflamed, they will clot off. So in elderly people, we tend to see it because of atherosclerosis and arterial occlusion. And in other people, we tend to see it because of venous inflammation, the inflamed veins that lead to occlusion, the thrombosis. Here is a segment of bowel. It was removed surgically, and here you can see it's all dark black blue. You can see hemorrhage into the mesenteric fat and so forth. I don't know. I suspect it was probably an arterial occlusion, somebody who had occlusion of a major division, say, from the superior mesenteric artery. It feeds a lot of the small bowel. Well, infectious enteritis is pretty darn common. We have viruses and bacteria and all manner of things, and indeed, this is probably the leading cause of human mortality around the world. In most of the world, the developing world, we have a very high infant mortality rate, as you probably know. I've trumpeted the business about tuberculosis and all that, and being how common it is in the world. But the leading cause of death, by the way, is malaria of adults. That's the leading cause of death in the world. They're all infectious diseases. But in children, that first couple of days of life, that first day of life is the most dangerous day you will ever have. More people die on the first day of life than will die the rest of that year. More people will die in the first week of life than will die the next 10 years. What do they die of on day one, day two, day three? They get infected. They get a gastroenteritis, and there's essentially no capacity. Once you squirt a little bit, you can become very seriously dehydrated and you die of vascular collapse. And infant mortality around the world is staggering in some places, and it's all due to infantile diarrhea. That can be viral or bacterial. We have a variety of things that will infect us, and we see all of these right here in the United States. We have them right here in Bloomington. God only knows the number of worms I saw. People bring them in the diaper, you know, and here's an Ascaris lumbricoides. Here's this thing that looks like a silver fishing worm. It was in my kid's diaper. How many dogs live in the house with you? You know, that sort of thing. Viral infections, I can't imagine, again, that there isn't anybody, if there's anybody in this room who has never had a viral enteritis, never had cramping, can't eat, you get the squirts, you puke a little bit, you get the squirts, that's a viral enteritis. Okay? Everybody in here has had that, I'm sure, several times over. Again, infection of the epithelial cells. Bacterial infections like Salmonella. Now, Salmonella is an interesting one because it can either just infect the bowel and stay in the bowel. We refer to that as an enteritis. That's in the infection of the bowel itself. Salmonella, however, can penetrate the wall of the bowel and spread around in the bloodstream, and it loves to live in lymph nodes and the spleen and stuff like that. And that becomes what's called typhoid fever. And that person is going to die with that. One of the interesting things about Salmonella and Salmonella infection only in the bowel is that we don't treat it as a rule. We don't treat it with antibiotics. It's extremely sensitive to certain antibiotics, chloramphenicol primarily, but we don't treat it because if we do, people don't seem to develop enough antibodies to it, and they will become silent carriers, and they may be carriers the rest of their life. This was what so-called Typhoid Mary carried. Mary Malone was her name, and she was an immigrant from Ireland, and she had it colonized her gallbladder. So we actually don't treat unless people are really sick. We'd rather give them fluids, make them feel better, and let them get over it on their own and develop the antibodies that they need so they have that IgA that's being secreted so they're never going to get it again, and we're going to ensure that they don't get colonized with it. Parasites, both multicellular and worms, multicellular here, worms and unicellular like Giardia. Giardia is one of the favorite ones we used to see a lot of in the summer over at the hospital. People would be out in hiking in Colorado, and sure enough, that did look like crystal clear mountain spring water, and we just drank it, and nobody realized that the mountain goats were crapping in the water 100 yards up the stream, and they all came back with giardiasis. So that was one that was kind of interesting. We saw a good bit of that all the way through the summer. Giardia is not an uncommon parasite. So there are a lot of things that will colonize or cause us grief, infections. Now, I do want to talk here about non-infectious inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, and this I definitely want you to know about. Crohn's disease, we do use, this is a good one that we use an eponym for because the symptoms are variable and the physical findings and particularly the pathology in here is somewhat variable. And so it doesn't lend itself well to some kind of descriptive diagnosis that says to you what this thing is. So we do use an eponym here. It's variably called granulomatous enteritis. The problem with that, only 40% of the people actually have granulomas. Transmural inflammation is the most common thing, and by that I mean it involves the full thickness of the wall of the bowel. And the bowel wall gets extremely thickened and really ceases to function as it should in terms of peristalsis and so on. Inflammation is not confined to the mucosa in Crohn's disease. We don't know of an infectious agent that triggers it. There probably is something like that. It occurs in genetically susceptible people to some extent. Again, granulomas occur about 40% of the time. One of the curious things about it is that if the bowel is inflamed here and it's resting against the abdominal wall becomes inflamed the same. A fistula will develop between segments of bowel. If they're lying next to one another and they're inflamed, a window will open between the two. So fistula formation, skip regions. Here you can see, here it is in the colon, here it is in the small bowel, and it involves an area, then it doesn't, and it involves an area, and so on. So there can be multiple areas involved. It can lead to scarring and fibrosis. It recurs. It occurs at a young age. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I would not be surprised if there are two or three people here who have Crohn's disease. Again, you get over it, it gets better, and then it gets worse, and so forth. It can lead to serious malabsorption process problems if it involves this part of the ileum, which is a very common spot, because that's where the B12 is absorbed. So there is, again, a genetic factor, kind of an ethnicity that we see. When it involves the colon and other parts of the bowel, but the colon principally, there might be an ever so slight risk of increased risk of cancer, but it's minimal, very minimal, as opposed to what I'm going to talk about in a minute here, ulcerative colitis, which is almost, has a substantial increased risk. So if you ever ask about it, the answer is no, there really isn't a significant increase here. So this would be a young person's disease, diarrhea, a lot of cramping. That people get real skinny because of malabsorption and so forth. Believe me, it's nothing you want, and it's a lifelong thing. You've got it, Buster, you've got it. It's that simple. Crohn's disease. Here's an example of inflamed segment of bowel. You can see how thick it is. It has become adherent to the part of the colon, and before long, there will definitely be a fistula effect. It may even be starting right here. And so this part of the small bowel probably isn't working very well, if at all. And we do a lot of surgery on these people, remove those portions. Here you can see the inflammation, and then the classic situation. Again, it always involves full thickness. And I have never sent over test questions that does not include something about that, okay? It's always transmural. I have some question that looks at the differences between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's. Here is sort of a granuloma beginning here in the lamina propria. It's not a consistent feature, not a consistent observation, but the transmural inflammation always is. And that distinction, well, we don't do a biopsy that gets the whole bowel wall. If we do something, if you're having colonoscopy or something, we don't do a biopsy that pokes a hole through the wall. So We really don't know that just from a mucosal biopsy. I'm going to mention something here because of some of the changes that are certainly in the news a lot, and that is celiac disease. Celiac disease is a gluten, a problem with gluten sensitivity. Gluten is literally that. It's the glue. It's the stuff that makes flour kind of rubbery, makes the moistened flour rubbery. And some people develop very serious allergic reactions to that, which leads to loss of the mucosa, or at least flattening out of the mucosa because of chronic inflammation in the small bowel. And these people have very serious problems with malnutrition. And you can see the normal condition of the small bowel has all these mucosal folds, which greatly increases the surface area. So you got a lot of surface area for absorption because you got all these mucosal folds here. If you have a lot of inflammation and everything becomes flattened out, then all you have is that flat surface. That's it for absorption. And that's just a fraction of what you have when you consider, you know, this kind of surface area there. How many miles do you think is in the coastline of Maine? The state of Maine. You ever been there? That's a neat place. It's not a very big state, is it? There's 3,000 miles. 3,000 miles of coastland, of coastal surface in the state of Maine. You see, this is like the state of Maine. You're counting on this undulating stuff like this, so you greatly expand the surface area for absorption. When you flatten that sucker out, bango, that's it. You only absorb a fraction of what you're bringing in. Plus, it's very painful. People have a lot of cramping and so forth. That I robbed straight out of your textbook, so you can see that, how that works. And the gluten is in the flour. And there is just about no, there is no wheat product that is gluten-free, I can tell you that. And it is a serious issue for many people. People learned this during World War II, immediately after World War II, what the connection was. Believe it or not, that's when it finally came around, because a lot of people in the occupied areas, Germanic occupied areas, were eating corn. And as soon as they got a chance to eat wheat again, all of a sudden people got sick. A whole bunch of people were sick, abdominal cramping, squirts, couldn't eat wheat, malnutrition, and so forth. And it was related to the wheat. Someone said, you know what? What we were eating before was all the corn, maize, and we didn't have this. And so they went back and looked at it, and that's how we actually unraveled what was going on there. Colonic disease. You can have congenital colonic problems. This is something that's a little difficult to understand what's going on here. You see this greatly dilated portion of the colon here, great big abdomen on this little girl here. What will happen is you have a little section right here. That's it right there. The disease is here. You might say, excuse me, Buster, but look here. There's the disease. Hell, I can see that. Okay, that's not the disease. The disease is right here. The disease is this section right here. There's a little segment that lacks the ganglia cells. So peristaltic wave moves down and it stops right there because the ganglia cells are absent genetically or congenitally absent, so you can't propagate the wave of peristalsis. So all the poop accumulates right back here. Peristalsis stops. It says, you mean the peristaltic stuff can't push it through here? No, it doesn't normally do that. It just is enough of a movement to sort of massage things along. Yeah. That's a really good question. No, it does not. Not to a great extent. But I'll tell you what does. The kidney, you have a lot of problems with kidney function and bladder as a consequence of that. I never thought about that, but no, really, we don't. That's because this is really on automatic pilot. The ganglia cell passes the signal from one to the next, and it doesn't require any cord connection. So when we go to surgically correct that, we take out this little piece right here. Now, I will tell you, if the bowel is dilated to this point, they often do take it out because it may not function quite properly. But actually, technically, from an anatomic standpoint, it has everything it needs there. And so what they would do is, while the kid was still asleep, they would send us over that section of bowel, and they say, do a real quick section on it, look microscopically at it, please, which I can do by freezing a piece, slicing it, staining it, and tell me if you see ganglia cells. And I would say, I don't see any ganglia cells at your surgical margin. So they'd take out a little more, and then they would send it over, and I would look at it, and I'd say, okay, now I see ganglia cells. So I know we're past the area, the dead area, you might say, or the area that's absent. And then you can sew them back together, re-anastomose it, and the ganglia cells will find one another. But if you got a region like this that is missing them, the whole electrical signal breaks down. It's just like cutting the wire, you know, to your television. So this is actually the disease portion here. This right here is just sort of everything just building up behind it. So surgically, we look for those ganglia, and we can tell them the coast is clear. All right, this is the other form of inflammatory bowel disease that I want you to know about, ulcerative colitis. This is confined to the colon. Only occasionally does it involve even the most distal portion of the ileum. It always starts in the rectum. There is a very consistent clinical pattern here. Again, it's typically a young person's disease, has a high incidence, a risk of cancer, greatly increases that risk. The inflammation is confined to the mucosa. It does not involve, it's not transmural. It always begins in the rectum, and it works itself the other direction. See, that's a lot different than Crohn's disease. Crohn's was here, there, was all over the place. Since there's no transmural, it doesn't actually cause fistula to form. What we see here are huge ulcers. All this thing here, it looks like a big polyp hanging off. Here's a polyp hanging off. It's not really a polyp at all. What it is just a little piece of mucosa that hasn't actually fallen off yet. And so we use the term pseudopolyps, of all things, to apply to islands of mucosa that have remained. And when the endoscopist looks in there, it looks like he may be looking at a bunch of polyps, but really what he's looking at, the mucosa is so ulcerated and it's missing in so many places. What that means is the poop is directly in connection with the muscle and stuff like that. You know, you can imagine all the crap, all the stuff you could absorb you don't want in the bloodstream. But what they look at then are these islands of mucosa that remain, that haven't yet died, and they have the appearance of a polyp. They're not a polyp at all. It's a pseudopolyp. Occasionally, someone will, all bowel function may quit, that is to say peristaltic action, and everything builds up in there, and you have a lot of blood and crud and fecal matter. Bacteria go wild, and then you absorb all kinds of toxins from the bacteria, bacterial walls and fragments, and that person is going to die. We refer to that as toxic megacolon. But this right here, autoimmunity, I think does play a significant role in it. I think people do develop antibodies against parts of the mucosal covering. This is something, though, confined to the mucosa. And the pattern is quite a bit different again. Again, it's remitting. This is a colon that was removed. It's been opened. And it does look like there are a lot of polyps in there. But what you really have, these are all ulcers in between. And what look like polyps are, in fact, just areas of mucosa that still hung together. That was probably a toxic megacolon. This right here is a biopsy of the mucosa, and that's all it is. It's a pinch biopsy. In fact, this is as deep as it goes. But we see lots of polymorphonuclear leukocytes in here. If we look, I doubt we're going to find anything that looks much like a granuloma. We see little abscesses that tend to accumulate and start in these mucosal crypts here. It'll start down here. So this is something that we see lots of acute inflammation with, as opposed to Crohn's disease, which, remember, if it had granulomas or anything even looking like a granuloma, it would make it sound like more type 4 or something like that. So those are lymphocytes. So this pattern is different. The clinical picture is different. Bloody diarrhea, bad cramping, comes very suddenly. Again, I would be surprised to find that we don't have somebody in this class with ulcerative colitis. It almost always is at least one person. The biopsy is different, the risks are different, and what happens with somebody who has bad ulcerative colitis is we do colonoscopies yearly, and as soon as it looks like there's enough cellular atypia in the biopsies, we just say your colon's coming out before it becomes malignant. And people who have had very bad, very hard to control ulcerative colitis, by the time they're 35, almost all of them have their colons removed. Everything's removed. They have a bag here that collects the stool. Otherwise, they're going to die with colon cancer. Again, in your book does a nice job with both of those, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Please look at that. Here's something that's not uncommon in elderly group, and that's partly because of lack of fiber in our diet. And this is one of those things where trying to push the stool along, and it gets to be very thick and pasty. It literally causes a little bit of a pouch to occur. And these are diverticula that are pulsion. So-called pulsion diverticula, they occur because of pressure inside. As the peristaltic action tries to work it along, and again, it's not got a lot of fiber there, so the poop is kind of really pasty and hard. These little things, boink, will pop out of there. And if that's all it is, that's diverticulae. Now they can bleed. You can have a blood vessel in there that might bleed. And that can be annoying. It's not generally the kind of thing you could bleed to death from. But if there's even a small amount of blood, one of the crucial screening tests we do for colon cancer, of course, is to look for blood in the stool, so it can trick us that way. So it's one thing if this is all it is, but you see, they get infected. You see, here's a ball of poop right over here. And if it gets a kind of inflamed and this little mouth closes off, swells closed, there's nowhere for this thing to go. It festers. You can see there's very little muscle around it. It's going to fester and rupture. So let me show you what they look like when things really get bad. So we looked at diverticula. This is diverticulitis. Very painful. It leads to basically cessation of function of this part of the bowel, to say nothing of leakage of infected material, abscess material out and around. So this is a serious complication. So diverticulae by themselves aren't necessarily a big deal, but when they become inflamed, that's a different picture. Yeah. This is not to any great extent. No, there probably is someplace a group of people who have very thin wall, but for the most part, no. Can't point to a gene or even a familial tendency that I'm aware of, apart from the fact that everybody eats the same diet. I mean, if you're all eating a low fiber diet, you're all going to have something like this. Colon cancer and colon polyps are an important consideration here because colon cancers come from a particular variety of polyp. Not every polyp that you have will do that. Now, they come in the adenomas, the benign form of growths. These are mucosal in origin. They originate with the epithelial cells on the surface. And sometimes they're just areas of thickening. See, a hyperplastic polyp over there is something that occurs because of irritation. You know, I'm sure there are people in here that play stringed instruments, you know, and you could show me the calluses on your fingers. You know, if you're working out hoeing the beans in your garden, you're going to develop callus. You know, the more you work with it, you get a thickened epithelium. It's part of a dealing with chronic stress. And so you develop a callus. Well, you can have that's hyperplasia, it's a hyperplastic thing. It's a response to a stressor. In this case, we do see hyperplastic polyps, which are just thickened areas of the mucosa. I don't know what they're related to, but that's really, they're the equivalent of a callus. Now, sometimes you do have actual mutation that occurs and you have glandular proliferation, clonal glandular proliferation. Now, that's a different beast. So these polyps can be adenomatous, such as we see here, or tubular adenomas, which tend to actually be pedunculated. It grows up on a stalk. These are the ones that actually have acquired a mutation. They come from a single cell that developed a mutation. That's not malignant. It's not, but one cell within that carries this mutation now is at risk to develop a second mutation that may then propel that one cell to become malignant and begin proliferating in a malignant, really uncontrolled fashion. These guys right here are benign, but when we see them, we're a little anxious about it because we know that happened. You did have a mutation in one cell, the so-called APC gene, the adenomatous polyp coli gene, and that is, these cells right here are not healthy cells. These guys up here really are. I mean, they just happen to be thickened up. It's like a callus on your hand. This guy right here has the potential. It's not a very great potential, it's not very high, but it has a potential that one cell that already carries that mutation and represents the growth of that little polyp, the blue part there, one of those cells may acquire another mutation, and then that cell now is malignant, begins to grow and uncontrolled in a manner in which it will invade. Here are examples of polyps. Here's a polyp that's coming into being and probably somebody who has familial polyposis. We always take the colons out as quickly as we can of those folks because they're going to get it. But that's a polyp. But all the cells that are growing out here, although they're not going anyplace other than growing out, they're not invading anything, they're not completely healthy. We know a little bit about colon cancer from people who live in a family who have familial polyposis. They have a gene defect in what's called the APC, the adenomatous polyp coli gene, and they grow millions and millions of polyps. And if you've got millions of polyps in your colon, and that's the only place they are, by the way. They're not anywhere else in the GI tract. But if you've got millions of polyps, and the chances are only one in a million that one of those is going to go malignant, well, you can do the math. That's it. You're going to have a colon cancer. End of story. So there's essentially a 100% chance that you're going to develop colon cancer. And often it is by the time the person is about 20, 18 or 20 that it happens. Here's an example. It just shows a kajillion polyps. Again, I stole that out of your textbook. But this is an open colon. It shows millions and millions of polyps there. Well, what's going on with colon cancer, whether it is of the familial nature, that didn't come out too clean, did it? Or whether it's one that you acquire, because most colon cancers occur just in I don't know if there's anybody in here with familial polyposis, but I would be surprised, to be honest with you. The same thing that occurs in that person, in that kindred, to go ahead, such that every single person will develop cancer, is exactly what happens with the average population. The average colon cancer occurs in somebody who does not have a familial tendency. But the sequence of events is exactly the same as the person who does. And that is, the first mutation that occurs is in this polyp coli gene. And this has to do with growth regulation of the cell, and it occurs in one cell, and then it starts to grow into a little benign polyp, and it simply sits there. But since it's clonal, of course, every cell that came from that carries that mutation. At some point later, this is showing the mutation that occurs, and then the release of transcription factors, elaboration of transcription factors that say, let's grow. So we've got a cell now that's growing, and every cell that comes with it now has that particular mutation. Now, if one of those cells acquires a second mutation, and it can be a variety of different mutations, then it becomes overtly malignant. Most of the colon cancers that we see occur here. And you can imagine why that's the case. They occur here because if we've got carcinogens in our diet, say from fried food, which is, by the way, an important source of it, when we fry and sort of break down those long-chain hydrocarbons, those fats, and make them into much smaller ones, sometimes those are sort of pro-carcinogens. And the stool becomes more concentrated. It's very watery here. It's very pasty over here, and then it sits there while, you know, you're waiting for me to shut up so you can leg it over to the bathroom here. And so the bowel wall, mucosa, has a lot of contact with the carcinogens that's in the stool there. So it doesn't come as a surprise that most colon cancers occur right there. Colon cancers that occur on the right and the left have a different set of clinical symptoms. This is a colon cancer on the right. This is depicting what takes place here. Colon cancers here can get to be quite large. And the reason they do is that the fluid that's coming out of the ileum right here is just as thin as water. It's amazingly thin. It's not like poop in any way at all. It's kind of yellowy and very, very thin. And it can flow around that tumor and out it goes. So people who are over here can get to have a fairly large cancer, which means it's probably already spread. It's in their liver and their lymph nodes. But it will be there for years. It takes years for this thing to grow. This thing didn't grow overnight. It didn't grow over a month or a week. It took 3 or 4 years to grow to that size. What it's doing is it's leaking, it's losing blood, it's leaking a little off. So people who have right-sided colon cancers almost always present with anemia. Over the course of 3 or 4 years, they bleed a tiny bit every day. It's not enough blood to actually see in the stool, but it's enough that in time it runs their iron stores down and they present with a microcytic anemia, with an anemia of iron deficiency. So almost always these guys present here, and they present fairly late in the course of that disease, so it's already in their liver and their lymph nodes. On this side, however, it's different. There might actually be the presence, if it bleeds a little bit, it's not going to get mixed in with the stool. It's not going to have, the blood won't be broken down by bacterial action as it goes around here. Right here, it will be seen in the stool. People will see blood on the toilet paper, or they'll have symptoms related. Say if it's growing concentrically, it will keep the things from moving. And so the end result will be that we have stool-related symptoms. In other words, they're constipated, or they can't pass stool, or it's very thin, and they see visible blood in it. And these right here tend to get noted earlier in the course because of that. And so we tend to have somewhat better luck with surgical repair, surgical removal, and so forth there. Again, genetics. Well, we just talked about the people who have the unfortunate APC mutation. We know that lack of fiber in the diet plays a role. A large amount of fat in the diet plays a role, and so forth. Those are the places it likes to go. This is depicting how it happens. We start out with a polyp, again an adenomatous polyp. It carries one mutation. It develops a whole variety of different mutations are potentially there to make an invasive malignancy develop. Again, this is what it looks like. It's an adenocarcinoma. It looks pretty much like cancers that we looked at already up in the stomach and other places, but it's the same basic mucosa that we're looking at. I want you to read about that. I'm going to try to get this done here. Appendicitis, there's your appendix. You can see that right there. I'm sure it plays an important role. I'm not sure what it is, but you can end up with inflamed appendix and it looks like a little skinny thing right there. Well, once it gets plugged up, the most common event that happens is that the appendix, in the mouth of the appendix, gets a little piece of poop that gets really dehydrated. We often refer to it as a fecal lith. It's really not a stone, but it plugs up the mouth of the appendix, and if the appendix can't push what it has in out of there, it's going to become inflamed. Here's a normal appendix. Here's one that's all blown up and infected. It's going to rupture and leak into the abdomen, and you're going to die with peritonitis. Inguinal hernias, I mentioned before, these are important sorts of things. There are two kinds of hernias, what we call inguinal and direct. The inguinal hernia we'll visit again when we talk about male reproductive, but what we have is a little bit of a patency here in that inguinal canal that allows a loop of bowel to come down and get stuck. Please read about the difference between inguinal and direct hernias. A direct hernia occurs where there's a direct protrusion through the wall of the bowel because of a weakness. Typically it's post-traumatic weakness or surgical weakness, or sometimes just a normal weakness. We don't have as strong abdominal recti muscles. And of course, right smack in the middle, there's very little of anything. And so parts of the bowel will kind of directly herniate right through the muscle, as opposed to follow this inguinal canal, which in some people remains patent, but should not. And again, what the long-term problem is going to be an incarcerated hernia leading to death of the bowel. And when it's going to happen, it's when you're on that airline flight to Australia and you're over the Pacific and there's nothing to do but sit there and put up with it and hope you can arrive before you become deathly sick from an infection from your dead piece of bowel. And on that happy note, I hope you have a good trip to Australia. Okay, there are two liver lectures recorded and up for you to listen to. They're about 45 to 48 minutes each. Okay, and that's what you would have had if I'd had the full time. I didn't. There you go. All right? Good.